All right, this is week number 5, and just a reminder, no, these guys didn't do it, don't worry. Hey, guys. We were just talking about people being late for Valentine's, unless you guys took each other out. I know Biagio wouldn't even take me for coffee, so I'm sure he's not going to buy his dad dinner. But anyway, this is week number 5, and we are on commandment number 3. Next week, as a reminder to you, next week we do not have class. We are taking the week off, I do believe, and you're going to find this out for those of you who are in problem text. You will be meeting next week. I think you might be moving your class a little bit earlier because we're not meeting at the 6 o'clock portion. So anyway, we do not have class next week. We will be right on target and starting back up the following week. So this is week number 5. Commandment number 3, and this is what it says from Exodus chapter number 20, verse number 7, says, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." And this is one of those, it doesn't give the exact consequence, but it does mention God's seriousness of this. It says, "For the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain." And obviously we're going to find out tonight there's many ways in which that can happen. So let's go to page number 50 in your notes. And we're gonna read through some of the facts of the law here that I have. The third and ninth commandment go hand in hand. Both are regarding the tongue and the language that is used by people. The third commandment is primarily dealing with our language towards God. Now we're gonna go through a few other things in the midst of that that may not be directly against God, but language in general and some of the ways that we use it in the wrong way. But for the most part, it is regarding our language towards God. The ninth commandment deals with the language towards other people. To take God's name in vain would mean to use it or represent it in a way that would be empty, worthless, or of no value. God's name is very important to him. In the Bible times, a name meant much more than it does in our day. As a matter of fact, in our day, basically, we, husbands and wives, sometimes it's just the wives, but they sit down when the wife is pregnant and they figure out what names are hot names right now and which ones are the cool names. We don't usually, now there's rare exception to this, but we don't usually pick a name based on the meaning of that name. I do appreciate when people put enough thought into it, but I'm going to tell you that I was pretty shallow when we picked our names and we used other means and people, we mixed some names in of people who were important in our lives. But we didn't go based on the meaning of the names. But in the Bible times, they did that. A name would many times contain the character quality of that person. Now, obviously, when a child is born, you're not going to understand the character of that child for quite some time. But in some instances that we'll look at, someone's name would change once they came into a relationship with God or Jesus Christ. It would tell a story of that person's life or integrity. God changed the names of many quote-unquote saints or people in the Bible after a significant change in their lives in relationship with God. For example, I have listed here Abram becoming Abraham, Sarai becoming Sarah, Simon becoming Peter, Saul becoming Paul, and Dan, did you go on a date? Oh, okay. And then we have Joseph becoming Barnabas, son of consolation or son of comfort. So we see many people having their name changed based on their relationship or newfound relationship with God or with Jesus Christ. When Moses was sent to rescue the Hebrew people from Egypt, he asked God who he should say sent him to do the job. God said to tell Pharaoh that I am had sent him. By that name, it was understood that the eternal, everlasting God was the one that sent Moses to Egypt. And by that authority, God was expecting them to listen. God's name holds authority and power. When we use it lightly or commonly, we become callous to its uniqueness. In which, you know, that's why I appreciate people who don't use it too much. And that's why many times when people would write it in the old days, they would either leave a letter out or they would use a different form of it. God's name becomes a household name like any other. That is when we use it in a vain or empty way. To signify and remind us of the importance of the name of God, the first thing that Jesus taught when asked how to pray was proclaiming to God, "Hallowed be thy name," Matthew 6:9. God's name is holy and should be treated differently than other names. And I have listed here some of the ways that God's name is used in vain. I'm trying to be as careful as possible, and so I've left some of the letters out. But obviously, I have heard many, many Christians say, "Oh my God." I have heard many people use that. I don't even like saying it to give an illustration. But I have heard many Christians use that. I mean, just flippantly or just without even thinking that it was anything wrong with that. Walking down, I can't even remember where it was now. I was with some other people, and we were in, it wasn't a church, but it was a church activity. I wish I could remember where that was now. It was within the last month, and we looked at each other, we were surprised as these Christian people, Christian teenagers walking by us, just, oh my God, can't believe that. And just callous to the name of God. Maybe you know some of these, or maybe you use some of these. Oh, for God's sake. My family, my Italian family, being, in my perspective, good Catholics, I mean, they go to Mass all the time, and yet very flippantly use God's name and swear using God's name, which I really don't understand. Then we have using God's name with God, oh my Lord Jesus Christ, Lord have mercy, I swear to God, Lordy, Lordy, look who's 40, honest to God. Now, that one could be used in different ways and sometimes not in a bad way. God Almighty, geez, oh God, and many other, we'll talk about some of the other euphemistic type uses of slang words that are really a playoff of God's name. I knew a guy in Michigan who went to our church that would, when something crazy happened, he would say, "Oh, Judas Priest." And you know, when I first, Judas Priest, why would you even invoke that? I'm not sure, but you know, really it's a playoff of Jesus Christ. That's really what it is. It's a replacement. But in my mind, I didn't think, to me it was still a shock, because at first I was like, why would he, Judas Priest, yeah. Because it was such a replacement of using the, I understood immediately what he was doing. And I just think that that's something, as we talk about this, and we talk about euphemistic words, that we'll find, I believe those to be very dangerous. Blasphemy in all of its forms, by the way, shows up a total of 59 times in 54 different verses. And that would be another way of looking at this. Taking the name of the Lord in vain would be blasphemy. That the word blasphemy simply means to defame, to rail on, to revile, or to speak evil. Webster says it this way, it's an indignity offered to God in words, writing, or signs, impiously irreverent words or signs addressed to or used in reference to God, speaking evil of God. Also the act of claiming the attributes of deity and someone basically who is taking the place of God or putting themselves in the place of God. So tonight as we walk through this, I am saying to you and challenging myself to be careful of the words that we use, even in replacement of, we say, well, I'm trying to be careful. So be even more careful, and let's live above reproach as we think about this. I think it was Missionary Pesky. Were we talking about this last week? And euphemistic swearing is completely out, isn't it? And why do you take that stand?
Like what you already addressed, it's just another, you're just hiding the true definition using another word.
Okay.
So, oh my word, is just another reference, or oh my gosh, or oh my goodness, all those things are just a continuation of breaking the standard.
So what do you do?
If I stub my toe, I say, ouch.
Wow, that's deep. So that's really how you feel then. I mean, ouch. That's good. So anyway, that's something to consider. Taking God's name in vain could be done in lifestyle as well as in our words. That brings to light three aspects to consider under this commandment. First is the concept of using foul, profane, or vulgar language. The second is a concept of swearing, the giving of an oath or a promise before God. And the third is the idea of taking God's name in vain through our lifestyle. And we'll show you that, show you how that is true in Scripture. All three of these aspects are important in regards to understanding the full ramifications of this third commandment. So let's look at these three things mentioned. Letter A, language. The use of foul language in the form of, as some would call it, cursing or cussing. Secular definitions of different forms of foul language, and this is taken from Rush Dooney's book, The Institutes of Biblical Law, but he mentions these, and the first one he uses is that of swearing. And swearing is the act of verbally expressing the feeling of aggressiveness that follows upon frustration in words possessing strong emotional associations. And, you know, people use this kind of thing all the time when frustration hits, when things don't go our way. I'm sure there are many, as it's called today, road rage. People get frustrated because someone doesn't go from 0 to 60 as soon as the light turns green. And maybe you're in that boat, and maybe not. I remember this. I printed off a couple articles. I remember this happening when I was living in Michigan. This happened in 1999, and some of you probably remember this. But the cussing canoeist, you remember that? He was arrested and fined for swearing in the presence of a lady, well, actually a whole family, but there was a lady and children involved. And this was in Traverse City, Michigan. The Michigan Court of Appeals yesterday struck down a 105-year-old law against using vulgar language in front of women and children, throwing out the conviction of a canoeist who let loose a stream of no pun intended there by them, but a stream of curses after falling into the water. A three-judge panel ruled in favor of Timothy Boomer. The jury had found him guilty in 1999 of swearing after tumbling into the Rifle River. He was fined $75 and ordered to work 4 days in a child care program. That's great. As long as he got things under control with his language, that's great. But the sentence was put on hold while the case was appealed. Enacted in 1897 and slightly reworded in 1931, the law says anyone using, quote, indecent, immoral, obscene, vulgar, or insulting language in the presence or hearing of any woman or child shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. The appeals panel said it would be difficult to conceive of a statute that would be more vague. And obviously, in their mind, they changed things. But this is what Boomer says, the guy who was the one guilty. He says, I'm a little more careful about what I say in public these days. I don't think I'll ever live it down completely, which is exactly why there should be some way or that we should do something in the form of holding people responsible for this. Here's another one, and I thank God I've never seen this show, South Park. But in one night, this is from, I don't even know what news one this is, but I have the article here using the S word 162 times in one program. And that is a 22-minute program, and they use the S word 162 different times. This is what it comes down to now, though, in the United States of America. And here's this article. Rock band sues TV network over swearing ban. Heavy metal rock group Motley Crue, they're suing U.S. NBC TV after its executives banned them from all the network shows for swearing during a live television performance last year. So not only is it not illegal anymore, but now it comes to the point where you can sue someone and win because you have been in one way or another held responsible for your language. And it's just incredible to watch how things have swayed if we're not careful and we don't take these things serious. Here's another one from Wisconsin. Robert Kassane didn't expect his rude comments to his niece's ex-boyfriend would cost him $212. And when Roberta Parrish was handed a $95 ticket for leaving an off-color message on her ex-husband's answering machine, she asked an officer, "Well, what did I say to deserve this?" Really didn't even understand what she was in trouble for. The disorderly conduct statute bars, quote, violent, abusive, indecent, profane, boisterous, unreasonably loud, or otherwise disorderly conduct when it provokes or causes a disturbance. And that's why they got themselves in trouble. But most of these laws in America are being overturned. There's probably not any states in America any longer that hold those laws, or at least that if they have them, they're tucked away somewhere where no one even knows about them. It is no longer an issue. What's that? Do you?
Can't swear in public place. Can't swear in public place. You're arrested.
So what do you do?
They're under arrest. When they start cursing, this bleep, you better be quiet because there's people standing around that can hear you're going to get locked up. Well, bleep, you're under arrest. It's a violation. It's not a misdemeanor, but you can't swear.
What do they have to do when they're arrested for that? I mean, what is there a fine?
Yeah, it's a fine.
Do you know?
I think $500 is the maximum fine. You can't swear. The only thing you have to prove in the statute is that people were capable of hearing what they were saying, which is pretty easy to do. You're in a public place, in the middle of the day, people are walking around. It's illegal. You can't hear.
Only you as an officer can.
Right.
Force,
not as. Right. Police can call and say, "Hey, this guy over here is cursing and swearing. I want him locked up." Yeah.
Does that make any sense to you? To me, that makes no sense. That we on network television can allow every swear word possible, but when you're physically live with someone, you can arrest someone for swearing.
I guess the argument they would probably use is you're watching it, so if you don't like it, turn the channel. Whereas the people that are out in public are being subjected to something that they might not necessarily want to hear.
And I can understand that, but at the same time, they don't warn me when a swear word's coming on TV. I mean, I might be willingly watching a TV show, but I'm not willingly warned that there's a swear word coming up.
Right.
And I guess to me, our country does not make sense on a lot of issues. When you have a guy being in California arrested and being charged for the murder of his wife and the unborn child, who they say is not even a person at this point. You can murder them in a hospital or in a doctor's office, but you can't murder them out in public. That's so duplistic.
The way the laws that say New York State, if you look at New York State penal law, you can be abortion by an unlicensed physician, or someone who is not a licensed physician is considered murder. But it's not murder if you're a licensed physician. I'm a little confused. How does that
Even like I'm taking a law class at school, and I have to say as a judge and a lawyer, and you got to see some of the stuff that she just brings forth. It seems pretty cut and dry, but then you got to see how constantly judges change the precedent. The laws are supposedly evolving because our language is evolving, and it's just a lot of stuff just like cut and dry today, and everybody's just milking up the Constitution. Like, no, you have this freedom of privacy, this freedom of. It's like what you're talking about, profanity. They got a guy on it. She was talking to us about it. He was coming home from a bar, and the cops, he walked out of a fight. He wasn't involved in it. And he walked to his house, got out of his porch, and started cursing. And they didn't know who it was to, either the police or whatever. So they knock on his door. He's in court, and he gets off because he has the freedom of his privacy because he's on his porch. Even though he's in the middle of everywhere in the city, and people could probably hear him, and it's late at night, and could have been a disturbance, he got off.
And most probably will. At least, I mean, that's just, it's amazing. I mean, and I'm glad you can arrest people. To me, some of the way they handle these things doesn't make a lot of sense to me, that we have the crying out for freedom of speech everywhere, and people defending that, and you do have freedom of speech except for swearing. I mean, it's a, I'm glad. I just don't understand how our society does some of these things and how we have two different rules going in two different directions. The second one was cursing. This is often used as a synonym for swearing, distinguished by the fact that it invokes or calls down some evil upon its object. People will tell someone to go to hell. That is a curse, calling down some kind of evil upon someone. The third one is profanity. This is often used as a synonym for cursing and swearing as well. It's a form of swearing in which the names of attributes of the figures or objects of religion are uttered. And obviously, I think you understand that. I don't have to give an illustration of that, and don't plan on it. But those are, it's using religious objects or figures to do that. The letter D is blasphemy. This is often identified with cursing and profanity, the act of vilifying, to make malicious or abusive statements about somebody, or ridiculing the figures or objects of religious veneration. Blasphemy, very much like in New York City when they had the Mother Mary and they used defecation as part of the art. And that, look at the response. I mean, I think there was some response, but it was pretty light in relation to what's going on with the cartoons about Muhammad right now.
Yeah.
I mean, in comparison, we as Christians really didn't say much. Now, obviously, we don't respond to some of these things like other people respond to the false gods that they worship, but blasphemy. Letter E is obscenity, a form of swearing that makes use of indecent words and phrases. A lot of these are very similar. Then we have vulgarity, a form of swearing that makes use of crude words. And he uses in his book the illustrations such as bloody and used in other countries. Then we have the one, letter G, euphemistic swearing, a form of swearing in which mild, vague, or corrupted expressions are substituted for the original strong ones. This is also known as slang. And illustration given, dang it, darn it, freaking, gosh darn it. These are some of the illustrations that he gives in regards to euphemistic swearing. It doesn't take much to see what those words are replacing as you hear them. And you know, it's amazing. It doesn't seem so bad until you hear someone young using those, and you're going, "Whoa, what?" You know that. And I think it's a little bit. We need to be warned of that as well. Our family has made use, and I don't know if you have, but we've made use of curse-free TV, The Guardian. This has been a great tool. We have watched programs that are supposedly children's programs on video in which a swear word is slipped in. It's amazing how they, even in the way they grade things, that they still slip those words in. And curse-free TV basically is based on closed captioning, so if something's closed captioned, this box reads ahead and cuts out the sound when a swear word's coming up, and it puts the it doesn't write the word down at the bottom, but it actually gives the content of what the sentence is without the swearing in it. And so all of a sudden the volume goes off and you start reading what's being said minus the swear word. And it's a fantastic thing. It was a gift to us from someone else in the church, and it has been a great thing for us. We can watch a show and not worry about what is going to be on it. Or you could throw your TV out too. I mean, there's a couple options here. But if you're not going that far, I would encourage you to at least look into that. You can get it at Sam's, Walmart, online, and stuff like that. But it's a great tool. It's great protection for all of us. What's that?
Can I get that for work?
Yeah. I wish you could hook it up to someone's head. So that, I do feel bad for you. I feel bad for my sister who works in the ladies' area of the prison. I know that there are probably worse, maybe, than some of the guys. But anyway, Biblical forms of foul or improper language, excluding the concepts of lying or deceit, which would be covered under the Ninth Commandment. So here's some of the words that are used in the Bible, some biblical words to describe this. Evil speaking. The word slander is used 3 times in the Bible, backbiting 4 times, angry expressions, talebearing, reproach, or even the concept of being a false witness, a liar. And that obviously will fall under the Ninth Commandment. The purpose of this type of talk is to hurt the reputation of another person through open communication of damaging information. This betrays trust, which many times is never won back. And as Proverbs 17:9 says, that it will separate very or close friends. But you've probably been there before, haven't you? You gave information that wasn't necessarily sinful information, but it was more information than you needed to give. Maybe sometimes it's to make you look better than someone else, to degrade someone else just a little bit, which makes you look just a touch better. I don't know if you've ever had the Holy Spirit tug at your heart when you're ready to say something and telling you not to. And if you're like normal, inside you're struggling with that thing, well, what's so wrong with that? You know what we like to do? We like to give shocking information to people. We want to be the first people to relay a juicy bit of information. And the question we have to ask ourselves is it necessary? Do I need to give this information? What is my purpose? What is my goal in communicating what I'm about to communicate? And we probably say enough stuff that we say so fast. I'm not going to say that even God can't keep up with it. But we say stuff so fast sometimes and so much. The Bible says in the multitude of words there wanteth not sin. There's not a lack of sin when you and I talk too much. And I think that if the Holy Spirit is convicting us, we better listen. And we can develop a habit of speaking correctly, of speaking what needs to be said. Imagine all the things that we could say in life, the righteous things, the good things. Imagine all the times that we could be sharing the gospel with someone. Or giving a good word of encouragement, or rebuking someone who needs to be rebuked, and we don't do anything. Those are the good things, those are the necessary things when we speak so often of things that are unnecessary. A couple of the verses that are mentioned here, Ephesians 4:31 says, "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice." Work at getting rid of this stuff. Mixed among things such as bitterness, wrath, and anger, we find evil speaking. Psalm 10, verse 7, "His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. Under his tongue is mischief and vanity." And God says this in Numbers 14:27, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation which murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel, which they murmur against me." And if you remember the history of Israel, there were times when they were not necessarily invoking God. They were invoking God's man, Moses, Aaron. Sometimes they were just complaining about the manna. They got tired of what they had. They were no longer content. And God took that as murmuring. I've been guilty of murmuring before, a couple times, complaining. Sometimes I have valid reasons, and many times I don't. When I was growing up, my mom and dad used to call it a song and a dance. You know, you stamp your feet and complain. And you know what? Sometimes some adults have never grown out of that. We continue to do that. At the age of 35, 40, 45, 50, we might do it in different ways, but I've seen grown men pout. Like, I'm thinking, what a baby. The pouting, you know, someone says something, you can just sense it, and it's like, and they just turn off and they walk away, and they may not have the poochy lip, but they have everything else that goes along with it. And God says murmuring is wrong. Barnes says this, Albert Barnes, he says, "The idea is that we are not to slander, revile, or defame anyone. We are not to say anything to anyone or of anyone which will do him injury. We are never to utter anything which we know will be false about him." or to give such a coloring of to his words or conduct as to do him wrong in any way. We should always speak to him and of him in such a way that he will have no reason to complain that he is an injured man. It may be necessary when we are called to state what we know of his character to say things which are not at all in his favor, or things which he has said or done that were wrong. But we should never do this for the purpose of doing him injury, or so as to find pleasure in it. And where it is necessary to make the statement, it should be so as to do him no injustice. We should give him no improper coloring. We should exaggerate no circumstance. We should never attempt to express ourselves about his motives or charge on him bad motives, for we know not what his motives were. That's something that Pastor Grace has said many times from the pulpit. He said, you can question what I'm doing, but don't question my motives. You and I might not agree with everything that goes on, but you cannot accuse him of having bad motives, because you don't know what his motives are. There are times when I will question the motives of my children on something, but I can't tell you that I know for sure what their motives are. It's pretty difficult to guess why someone's doing something. And when you start getting into that kind of mindset, you become a very negative person. Why did that person give that much money? Someone gave Pastor $7,000 in one sitting for the new building? Why? Why would they do that? Are they trying to buy their way into heaven? Why would we even need to think something like that? And when we start getting into that kind of thing, we're questioning people's motives. We are in a very negative state, and things need to change. As he mentions, there are times when you and I have to give a true, accurate account of someone. For example, I am many times asked by students to fill out a reference form for college, or a reference form for Encounter Revival Ministries. They're interested in going, and every year we have a large number of students. This year I think we had about 12 students who tried out for the team, and then we have a good handful of students that want to work there for the summer. And whenever they come to me, I say, now listen, I'm going to be honest. I've got to tell them what I know. And there are times when I don't know much. If I don't know much, I don't put much down on the paper. I'm not going to make things up, because the last thing I want is the last thing I want is for them to get to the camp, for example, to serve, to be nothing but a thorn in the flesh to the people there that are running the ministry, and to have them say, "But you said that this of them." And whenever something has come of somebody that I have recommended there, I have always told Artie, I said, Artie, I told you. I warned you. He said, yeah, I know. And he said, because I warned him of someone in the, I'm not going to say when, because there's people in here who know people who've tried out. In the last 7 years since I've been here, that I warned him. I said, man, Artie, listen, he will benefit more than you. You will not benefit from this person as much as this person will benefit from your ministry. And in talking with him later, he said, because he told me, he said, I look at it as an opportunity to disciple someone. And of course, he loses hair. He loses, he gains age quickly. And he understands when he's done what my warning was. But I have to be honest in those kind of situations. I don't want to color someone to be good if they're not. And I don't want to color someone to be bad if they're not bad. I want to give an accurate rendering of them. And so there are times when we need to do that, but we need to be careful personally of our own motive in doing so. Letter B is railing. On top of page number 52, to taunt, reproach, or blaspheme. 1 Peter 3:9 says, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrarywise, blessing, knowing that ye are thereunto called, that you should inherit a blessing. This sin of railing is seen especially heinous when it is used against parents. The parents are God's representative authority, and therefore we are cursing God by cursing parents. And God takes it serious enough where in Exodus 21:17, as I mentioned in the notes, that he that curseth his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Blasphemy, letter C, rebellious language directed against God. And blasphemy, as we mentioned, is not just a verbal thing, it's also a lifestyle thing. But that's another biblical term for this kind of sin under this commandment. We have letter D, corrupt communication, which means to be bad, decayed, or rotten. It is used in a moral sense, as our word corrupt is, to denote that which is depraved, evil, contaminating, and may denote here anything that is obscene, offensive, or that tends to corrupt others. Maybe some of you, and here's something that usually comes out, is the concept of sarcasm. Anybody really good at that?
Yeah, I know.
Sarcasm is a very easy, it's actually can be, is a one of the most used forms of humor, because it makes everyone laugh but the person is the target. And it can be so fun. That was sarcastic. It is very common, as a matter of fact, and usually very hurtful. I have heard people, and you know what, sarcasm usually happens where you're most comfortable, and you'll use it at home, and it'll be very hurtful to the people in your home. But sarcasm. Someone give me an illustration, because I can see smiles all over the room. What is a sarcastic statement that you would use? Besides, oh, really?
When Christ said, "Here is a Galilean in whom there is no guile," he was being sarcastic.
Wow.
And you know that for sure. Huh?
Is there a man that there is no guile? Besides Christ.
He could have been living. Plus, he was just talking about Jesus beforehand. He was saying,
"Okay,
he had guile in his mind."
Okay.
Well, sometimes sarcasm can be used as a subtle means of making a point without addressing it directly. In a way, it can be a merciful way of addressing a potentially inflammatory subject. But usually it's not. Well, I'll grant you that. It's usually not used for those purposes. It's used for destructive ends or selfish means. But to support what he's saying, I think that Christ potentially said, "Oh, look, in Israel, indeed, there's no guile."
Mm-hmm.
You know, to make a subtle point. I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was helping to point out something true. Understood.
All right, so that is... So understanding that there are so many different formats or so many different sub-points under this that need to be considered. Sarcasm being one of them. Ephesians 4:29, "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers." I know people that are very positive people. I know people that when something good happens, those are the first people I want to go to, because usually they have something good, something encouraging to say. If something's going bad, they're still the same people that I like to go to. I also know other people that are very negative, that I don't like going to them. There are circumstances in which I do not go to certain people. There are days when you don't need a wet blanket on your parade, you know, and usually you'll get that from certain people. I want to have the reputation as a positive one. No corrupt communication, things that would be hurtful, decayed, rotten. Those are the kind of things that I do not want. Letter E is filthy talking, obscene or indecent conversation, which is shameful. It's also described as indecent or inconsistent with the modesty of the godly. And as Gill says, it includes all impure words. These discover an impure heart and are the means of corrupting men's minds and manners. Filthy speaking is a verbal commission of the things that are spoken of. And it may include all impure songs and books in the reading or hearing of them. And so he kind of includes in there not only the commission of those, but actually the root cause of them, what we fill our hearts and our minds with. Ephesians 5:4, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather the giving of thanks. Even a fool makes mock of sin. And so often we will use those kinds of things to make people laugh. When we are laughing at sin, we are heaping upon Christ. I mean, those are the things that He died for. We're mocking them. We're using it as a source of laughter, which one of the reasons why late night TV is so popular among people. That's all those guys do is use sinful things going on in our culture to inflame laughter. And you and I want to be different than that. We need to be set apart. Letter F is foolish talking. This is the kind of talk which is senseless, unnecessary, stupid, foolish, which is not fitted to instruct or edify. Idle chit-chat, which is so common in the world, according to Albert Barnes. We're probably very guilty of this. One of the verses I really don't like that we have memorized this year on Wednesday night is Matthew chapter 12, where it says, every idle word which men shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. Is that how it starts? Every idle...
12:36.
Yeah, how does it start? Is that how it started? Okay. I was thinking I was missing something at the beginning. Every idle word. I don't like that verse. Because I've used a whole lot of conversation that may not even been sinful, but it was more than I needed to talk about, more than needed to be said. Let's look at a couple of this under number two, and we'll take our break. To better understand foolish talking, we must better understand the foolish person. The fool is mentioned 61 times in 60 verses in the book of Proverbs alone. Here's some of the things that are said about them. They lie and slander. Letter B, they use angry words. A fool's wrath is presently known. They can't even hold it in. When they're upset, you know everything that's going on. And letter C, their conversation lacks excellence. Their words are contentious. They are troublemakers. That didn't move. They speak more than they should. Proverbs 29:11, a fool uttereth all his mind. Here's sarcasm, you ready? For some it doesn't take long to do that. But they utter all of their mind. they try to instruct on the future and God's will. Paul Harvey today on his news and comment was talking about some guy who tells the future and fortunes, and he used his crystal ball, and he laughed because he said he couldn't tell the future enough to know that the sun coming through his crystal ball would start his apartment on fire, and it burned down his apartment. And so that was kind of interesting. Couldn't tell the future too well, or he would have moved his crystal ball out of the sunlight. Letter H, they despise wisdom and instruction. Letter I, they are naturally attracted to evil. Letter J, they make fun of sin and use sinful things to make others laugh. I mentioned that one just a moment ago. Fools make a mock at sin. And then letter K, they speak before thinking. A fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in till afterwards. Seest thou a man that is hasty in his words? There's more hope of a fool than of him. And holding things in, being careful of what we say and when we say it. Let's take a break right there, and we'll come back at gossip. Gossip is the spreading of unfounded information that is not edifying, not necessary, and possibly not even true. The kind of talk is careless, idle, and purposeless chatter. And we're probably, although we condemn gossip and we preach against gossip, probably all of us are guilty quite regularly of giving more information about other people than what needs to be said. There are some primary causes of this corrupt language in us. And obviously we all know that letter A is the primary one. The root of all foul language is the content of our hearts. This is what feeds our mouth with its language. And we need to be washed with the washing of the water by the word is what we need. And but Jesus asked this question in Matthew 15. He says, "Do not ye yet understand that whatsoever entereth in at the mouth goeth out into the belly and cast out into the drought? But those things which proceed out of the mouth come forth from the heart and defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man." And the more we can do to avoid hearing the language of other people that is foul, that is wrong, that is abusive, the better off we're going to be. Some people can't avoid it. Some people have more of it than what others have in their work settings. And what do you do to help yourself?
Let me tell you how my day starts out. You go to the locker room, there's pictures of nude women hanging up all over it, skin magazines all over the place, obscenity flying left and right. I mean, you basically just got to walk in with your head down, go to your wall locker, get your stuff out, get it on quick, and get out. There's really not, I mean, you walk in my locker room, it's like walking into an adult bookstore. There's nothing I can do about it. I mean, it's, you know. Now, yeah, you can change the home too. You know, then the language that you hear from, you know, in all just nonstop, you know, obscenities, filthy jokes, whatever. I mean, it's not easy. Then you go on jobs. And you go in houses, and you hear every filthy word in the book, and you see all kinds of things, you know, that you shouldn't be, or you shouldn't be seeing, you shouldn't be looking at. I mean, I went to an alarm the other day. The house was unlocked. I had to check it. It's 400 people in the house. What do you do? Do I check the house? I have to check the house. It's my job. It could be a burglar in there. Nonetheless, here's all this pornography laying out all over. That's why I can see it.
You accidentally dropped the match, didn't you? A little bit of gasoline.
Or you just, you know, people deal with people. I mean, they nonstop one obscene word after another. You know, as a matter of conversation. And you deal with street people. I mean, it's the way that they are, the way that they talk. I mean, a lot of it I have to put into depositions or crime report. I have to actually repeat what I've heard. I had to write obscene words because you had to write exactly what they said. It's not easy. I don't enjoy it.
No, I can't imagine.
You can understand. You have to say exactly what they said. If they use obscene language, you have to use that language. You have no choice. You're on the road. I don't want you. But there's nothing I can do about it. I think God understands. I think he likes us. I think he has my hope. He understands.
And you just do what afterward? I mean, how do you clean yourself up?
Well, you gotta take it to the Lord in prayer. You know, you basically review my whole day with God. God, I had to do this. I saw things that I shouldn't be looking at. God, I said things that, you know, I had to go through the course of testimony or whatever. I know that those words are offensive to you, Lord. You know, I heard things today that I didn't want to hear. I had to hear.
So, I mean, some people work in more difficult circumstances than others, obviously, and we just have to avoid it as much as we possibly can. That'll be the best help for us. Obviously, your situation is different than sitting in front of a television and willingly playing it in our living room. So. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's tough circumstances. I remember there's a guy that I look up to in Michigan. He was a state trooper in Michigan, and same testimony, struggle with that stuff. And of course, he struggled with pornography before he was living for Christ. And when the Lord started dealing with him in certain areas, that was one of the areas. And so he started trying to deal with it with himself in his own way.
And he would walk into the station, and he would start gathering up when no one was looking. He'd be walking it out to the dumpster. And he said one day one of his fellow officers came in his car around the corner and saw him and kind of dumped it real quick. And, you know, the guy said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Nothing." And he said, "What are you throwing away?" He said, "Nothing." He was trying it all in his own flesh. But so the guy went and told everyone, this is what Tom's doing. He's throwing away all the magazines. He's the one that's doing it, you know. Of course, everyone turned on him, and he came up with a plan of what he was going to do. In the next one of the next mornings, and in the next few days, he went in and into the locker room area, and they called his name. He heard the crinkle of paper. And, of course, he knew what they were doing. He grabbed his stuff, and he went out screaming. I mean, top of his lungs, screaming. And he came running up the stairs, and his boss came out like, you know, "What's going on?" He said, "They're trying to show me pornography." He says, "I've been there, and I'm not going back again." And he said that was his day of victory. That was when he started to win the victory over that. And quite a testimony.
Well, we had a temporary reprieve because the cop's 7 or 8 year old kid went in. He's a bit. Didn't come out for a while. The cop went in and found his kid sitting down going through skin books.
Mm-hmm.
Now he blows a gasket. This is one of the, I mean, and this is a guy who has no problem at all with pornography. He's a lost guy. Went to the chief, made a complaint, got removed temporarily. A lieutenant actually went upstairs to the chief of police and lobbied on behalf of the men to get the pornography restored, because the men needed it.
Needed.
You believe that? They got restored. They got put back in. I mean, they needed the pornography.
Well, the stress of the job.
Yeah,
the stress of the job. Okay. Unchecked anger is letter C. Letter B was the fear of man. Letter C, unchecked anger. That's one of the sources. If you and I are not careful and we allow, I believe this, and maybe you disagree with me, but I believe that anger is a learned habit. There are some of us that will struggle more with anger, but I believe that the more we do it, the quicker we get angry. We get angry at smaller things. Our temper is blown out of proportion a lot quicker than it used to be. I believe it becomes a learned habit. And if we're not careful, that will be our testimony. Proverbs 14:17 says, "He that is soon angry dealeth foolishly." Now, how many of you have ever hit an inanimate object? Okay, I'm all by myself. Okay, we got a few of you. What in the world did that accomplish? Zero. Besides hurting yourself again, so you want to throw something else. You kick something. You throw something. It's uncontrolled, unchecked, angry. And you know how foolish? You sit back and you think of that, what you just did, and then you envision your family watching you, and you begin to blush and feel like an idiot. Swearing? Euphemistic swearing? You feel foolish. Why? That is such a silly thing. A terrible way for an adult to act. And so unchecked anger. Letter D is pride. And two of the illustrations I mentioned, number one is Balaam, and number two is Jonah. Those two guys got mad. One got mad at an animal, a donkey. And Jonah, of course, got mad at the gourd. Two inanimate, well, one is an inanimate object, and one an animal. And, you know, just how foolish they looked. And, of course, the only difference between us and them is they are forever recorded in history, in the Bible, never to be forgotten. That really does stink. Letter B is lip service, the use of language in the form of vows and promises. God's name was not to be used for any idle, frivolous, or insincere purposes, such as speaking His name when taking an oath with no intention of keeping it. And God's name is used and still is used in most situations in taking an oath, making a promise that you're going to tell the truth and nothing but the truth. Here's some of the different illustrations of that. Number one, making vows that are not kept. And Ecclesiastes 5 talks about being careful of that.
Be not rash with thy mouth. Let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. Now, understand, I'm going to tell you that I believe that making commitments to the Lord is an important thing. I think make commitments to the Lord regularly. But at the same time, we need to be careful of the commitments that we're making to the Lord, because He is listening. And we need to not be rash about that. But I believe it's a good thing for us to go up to the altar, to make a commitment to the Lord. When He speaks of something to you and I, deal with it. Make a commitment to Him. But be careful not to do it rashly, not having any desire, any plan to keep that. A couple other of the illustrations in Leviticus 5 talks of the importance of keeping our word and the pronouncement of an oath. Very important. Number two is making foolish vows that should never have been made. The biggest example of that, of course, is Jephthah, who vowed unto the Lord. He said, "If thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into mine hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering." And we all know what was the first thing that came out of his house. His daughter. Now, there are those who do not believe that Jephthah kept his vow. I'm not sure how you can come to that conclusion. Jephthah's vow was that he would offer a burnt offering of whatever it was that came out of his door. And in verse 35, it says, "It came to pass when he saw her, he rent his clothes. And it says, Alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth, and I cannot go back." And he also said in verse 39, "And it came to pass, at the end of 2 months, she returned unto her father and did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed." And there are people that don't like that. There are people that don't think he kept his vow. But I can't find any scriptural evidence that would show otherwise that he did not do what he did. Was it smart for him to do what he did? No, I don't think so. I think the vow was a foolish vow. It was stupid. I don't know what he expected to come out of his house when he got home. But either way, I believe he kept his vow. The lesson for us to learn is it's more important to keep God's commandments than it is our own vows. And I think that's an important thing to understand. Peter made a vow by swearing that he did not know Christ. He began to curse and to swear, probably in the form of saying, "I promise, I do not know that man." He began to curse and to swear. Whether that meant also some the swearing that we know it to be or not, we are not sure. There were some exemptions from the vows that we have in the Bible, Old Testament. A girl living at home that has a father could disallow her vow, could keep her from keeping that vow. He could change it for her. The other exemption was a lady that has her husband disallow her vow on the day that she voices it. The husband heard it, disagreed with it, he could relieve her of that vow. And so there were a few exemptions from those things. Other than that, God says, keep your word. God warns us not to swear at all. Our lifestyle should be such that we do not require a vow for our words to be accepted or reliable. You often hear people say, "No, I promise. Honest to God, I did. Honest." It's pretty sad commentary on our own lives if we have to beg someone to believe us. Our words ought to be so reliable and trustworthy that people say, "Well, he said he didn't, so he must not have." Or, "He said he did that, so he must have done it." And that ought to be our testimony, that our yea should be yea and our nay should be nay. Verse 37 of that chapter that we see beginning at the bottom of page 56, Matthew 5, it says, "Let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil." And that ought to be true of us. Letter C is lifestyle. Taking God's name in vain through the way we live. As New Testament believers, we carry the name of Christ as Christians. We ought to live in a way that we need to live in a way that accurately represents Him. You need to be careful. This commandment tells us that if we take upon our lips His name, we must not deny His character. And a couple ways that this happens. Hypocritical living. Hypocrisy is not living different than what we feel. It's living different than who we are. Our position in Christ. We know who we are. We ought to live accordingly. Number two, through our lack of honor given to authority in the workplace. This is what it says in 1 Timothy 6:1. Let as many servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, that the name of God and His doctrine be not blasphemed. And we give an account, we give an opportunity for the enemies of Christ to blaspheme when we do not give the honor to people that are due that honor. Another way of doing that is through the lack of submission of a wife. Titus 2:5, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. So blasphemy, although we can speak it, it also occurs when you and I live differently than what we know we are supposed to live, differently than what our character should be according to Scripture. It also happens in the form of intentionally striking a parent. Exodus 21:15, and he that smiteth his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And they considered that as a part of blasphemy, dishonoring the position of the father and the mother. And in the New Testament, despising the poor. James 2:7, do not they blaspheme the worthy name by which they are called if we're not careful to take care of the poor. I think that, I think we have to look for ways as individuals as well as a church to do that. Looking for ways to help people that are less fortunate. I think sometimes we get so busy and we get so caught up in what we do as a overall ministry that we lose sight of some of these smaller areas that God sees as very big. It's important for us to continue to do that in different ways. I love that we do things at Christmas for those who are less fortunate, Thanksgiving, reaching out to some of the children in the bus ministry. And I think that those are some of those things that we can do. And I think that we need to be careful individually that we keep doing that because the name of Christ can be blasphemed if we're not careful in taking care of that. That's what Jesus said too. And, if you've done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. All right, let's look at some of the consequences surrounding this commandment. The consequences of using foul language. Number one, our misuse of words will be discovered and our sin will find us out. I don't know how this works, but Ecclesiastes 10:20 says, curse not the king, not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. I don't know how that happens. But somehow, there are ways that people hear what we say. Our words are found out. That which is spoken in secret will be proclaimed on the housetops. Numbers 12:1, Miriam and Aaron spake against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman, and they said, hath the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not also spoken by us? And the Lord heard it. Boy, those are tough words, those last few words. The Lord heard it. We will be held accountable by God for our words and conversations. We've already mentioned Matthew 12:36. Then in the Old Testament, and you can flip there if you don't have it, open Leviticus 24. This is going to be broken down into three different things as to how this is dealt with in regards to the penalty. In Leviticus 24, starting in verse number 11, this kind of illustrates this for us a little bit. The Israelitish woman's son blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed, and they brought him unto Moses, and his mother's name was Shelomith, the daughter of Dibri, of the tribe of Dan. And they put him in ward, that the mind of the Lord might be showed them. And that's the illustration we talked about in week number one of some form of prison or detainment. And usually not something that's used in biblical law, but it is in this case until the time period given in verse 12, that the mind of the Lord might be showed them. Verse 14, bring him forth that hath cursed without the camp, and let all that heard him lay their hands upon his head, and let all the congregation stone him. So part of the principle is this. Everyone who heard him curse or swear were to take part in the consequences. That does a couple things. Number one, I'm not going to be too quick to condemn someone or too quick to say that of someone unless I'm sure of it. It doesn't mean that it should stop us if we do hear it, but I want to be sure. I'm not going to jump to that conclusion too quickly. I want to be sure of that because I know what's going to happen. I am going to have to take part in the penalty. I'm going to have to pick up a stone and take part in killing someone. Now, you got to imagine putting yourself in that kind of a situation before you understand the ramifications of that, how difficult it is to take part in putting someone to death because of your accusation. I believe that God does it that way for that, at least part of that being the reason. It's going to keep me honest. I can't give an accusation against Steve and then walk away and let all of you deal with it. I had to take part in that. And it keeps things honest. But anyway, so let the congregation stone him. So people took part in that. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, whosoever curseth his father shall bear his sin. And he that blasphemeth the name of the Lord, he shall surely be put to death. And all the congregation shall certainly stone him, as well the stranger as he that is born in the land, when he blasphemeth the name of the Lord, shall be put to death. And so capital punishment was incorporated in this as a consequence. When someone would curse or take the name of the Lord, blaspheme the name of the Lord, they were put to death. And it was a lesson. It was a lesson for all who not only partook, but a lesson for all who knew what happened. That's what happened in the New Testament, Acts chapter 5. When Ananias and Sapphira died, great fear came upon all of them in the church. Church discipline really does work. And so do the consequences when people break the law. If it's carried out and carried out correctly. People obviously argue against the death penalty. And their only argument really is that some people have died, some people have been innocent, and have been caught up in that. And I understand that problem. If it's carried out correctly, I believe that it will be handled correctly. And the innocent people will be found out to be innocent. But for that to hinder us from doing what is proper and right, people say, well, that doesn't stop people. It sure does stop people. If it's carried out consistently, people do see that, and they do fear. It goes into their mind right before they're ready to kill someone. Man, I remember what happened last, my friend who killed someone, what happened to him. And it does stop people. It's something that will hinder people from doing things. The problem is that we're not consistent. Someone will be on death row for 20 years in America at the cost of at least $50,000 a year just to take care of these people. And we'll keep them on death row for 20, 22 years with appeals and all these different things that happen. And then even down to the last minute appeal to the governor of the state, and an execution is stayed, and put them back into the system, and we continue to go through that process. Well, it's no wonder that people keep murdering at the rate that they murder at. What's the bad thing about it? And I understand they don't have freedom. I'm not saying that prison's a great place to be. But some people, prison is a great life, better than what they have in the real world. They have to fight in some places to have a good meal. Well, you go to prison, you get free squares. You get cable TV at no cost to you. You get a library where you can do your own studying and eventually defend yourself in the court of law. You've got a great place to work out. and becomes, you know, in shape and muscular. They have everything you could ever want in life. And for some people, that's a good life. So what's the detraction from murdering someone, if I'm going to go there? Again, I'm not saying that life is good in prison, but for some people it is. It's not that bad compared to what some people have. So I think the consistency is an issue. The question is, and maybe you can help us with the answer to this, the Lord will not hold them guiltless. What does that mean? The Lord will not hold them guiltless is what Exodus chapter 20 says, that take His name in vain. What does that mean? So they will not be forgiven if they do not ask. Okay. Other input. Okay. Do you think there's a level of severity on that, or is it, what's the accountability? Okay. So we have a level of accountability. Lord will not hold him guiltless.
I think it's just another... It's a reminder to say, because I think the Lord understands that it might seem like a light thing or a thing of not great consequence. Earthly consequences may not seem that great to take his name in vain. But the Lord has to add that, well, just rest assured, even though you might use these words, you know, casually, and it might, nothing great may come of it, that in my judgment, you're not going to be helped with it.
So you're leaning more toward the earthly punishment?
No, the heavenly punishment. Well, punishment regardless is punishment. Yeah, but I'm just saying that there may not be great consequences as far as you may get a repercussion here. You may not see repercussion, but God is saying just rest assured that even though you may not see a judgment coming your way, it is coming your way. Because I'm saying you can utter a word, and, you know, chances are nothing, you know, cataclysmic is going to happen to you. I mean, we've seen that happen, you know, Steve says he sees it every single day, you know, in the locker room. Nothing, he never saw a man yet hit by a lightning bolt or one of those utterances. But God says, just rest assured, that does matter to me, and there will be judgment coming your way.
Does that stand for Christians? Does it stand for everybody? Guiltless. Here's the question that comes up many times. Guiltless, is that in regards to consequences? Is that in regards to, is it forgivable?
Sure. Anything meant as a true repentance is absolutely forgivable. But that's why God is saying, I'm not going to hold you guiltless. Don't think that just because it was uttered and no one heard it or whatever, that it can just be, it just vanishes into thin air, like words seem to. There's weight. The whole thing behind the law is to say that my name has weight. It is so easy to say, oh God, it is easy to utter those things and to not think of it. But God is saying, wait, not so fast. My name has weight. It means something. You cannot just utter my name. And I also think that part of the reason why I think God's name is so powerful, our ability to utter it is such a powerful thing, that when we do utter it, we are arresting, if you will, God's attention. We're saying, oh God, if you look, oh, just... You just say it? Oh. We don't think that we have this power in our speech and our words, but I really think that we're connected to God in a more profound way, especially as believers, than we think we are. We just toss around words that like nothing, But the whole message today that we're getting from what God is teaching us here is that our words are far greater weight than we might ever dare to imagine.
Is there something special about this commandment then? I guess aren't we going to be? Will we be guiltless regardless of which commandment? I mean, will God say, "Okay, commandment, you broke commandment number two. You had an idol. No biggie." But when we come to commandment number three, you'll not be held guiltless. I mean, is there something special? I guess is one of the questions.
Just in general, you look at your actions, label your decisions. I mean, your decisions label your actions, and then ultimately it's going to equal your life. So, you may not see the whole picture yet. What you do, someone, I think God's saying here is like, look, your decision is going to result in your action. Your action is going to result in your life or your lifestyle. And which is ultimately like, if you keep going on with this, it's going to be kind of like indebted in a sin constantly. So I think that's kind of like what he's saying. So like, in a way, it's kind of judgmental that he's doing that. Like, you're going to be held accountable. You might not think of it, like, you might not see the whole picture now, whether it might be like, a judge at the throne, or his judgment will be cast out on your life throughout life. Like, you see, like, if you sin, you struggle. If you sin, we will struggle down the road. We'll have further problems from our sin. I think that kind of has to do with it here.
So will Steve be forgiven when he uses those words in his deposition? I'm not picking on Steve, obviously, but I don't see intent in the verse. I mean, it doesn't give us room for motive.
He didn't take the name of the man.
But if he repeats it on in court and he says, this is what they said, they said, GD, I can't. Okay.
He's not trying to publish it or to advance it. That's not his will. He is called as an officer of the law and as a good human being to present the truth. Because in heaven, when we're judged for things, God's going to replay our sins for us, or for the sinners, or for the judgment seat of Christ. Did you do this? Weren't these words uttered? And God's not going to be held, at guilt for, you use my name here. You said, God. And God's not going to become guilty suddenly of uttering, of that sin, just because you did that. Yeah, I understand that these lines seem hazy, but I really think there is a clear line there. And a lot of it has to do, we know from the New Testament that it's the spirit of the law that brings life. It's the letter of the law that is a curse or a death.
Okay.
Must be justified in your heart too, not just out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. So if I'm reading something that somebody else said, that's not from my heart.
I'm trying to differentiate. Now, I don't, because in this passage, in Exodus 20, I don't see anything that to deal with motive, personal motive. If I utter it, I utter it. I mean, am I going to be held responsible for that? I mean, in the situation where these guys are in, and they have to replay something and re-say something that would be considered taking the name of the Lord in vain, what does that mean to them? What does it mean to be held guiltless? Then they will not be held guiltless. Yeah. Thanks for encouraging our fellow. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Okay, let's move on. Let's look at a few other things, though. Consequences of breaking our vows. That's something we need to think about. Maybe that's something to do for homework. No, we won't do that. Consequences of breaking our vows. We will develop a reputation that is contrary to God's character. God never lies, nor breaks his word.
We are never more contrary to His nature than when our words are not trustworthy. And John 8:44, Jesus spoke this very clearly. He said, "Ye are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it." I know some Christians that have a reputation of being a liar. They can just as naturally speak lies as they can the truth. And I know some people. I think that they have developed a habit, and to them, they don't even notice it anymore. They add to the truth to make themselves look better. They detract from the truth just a touch to protect themselves, to protect their reputation, or to make themselves look better. And it is a regular part of life for them. That is of the devil. The consequences of living contrary to the character of God: the name of God is blasphemed, according to Romans 3:23 and 24. And common sense is we become a stumbling block to the people coming to Christ. There can and should be church discipline for offenders. 1 Timothy 1:20, Paul said this: "Of whom is Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have delivered unto Satan, that they might learn not to blaspheme." Now, everyone's going to have their own concept of what it means to deliver someone unto Satan. But the fact is, there was some church discipline there. Some people that were dealt with very seriously in regards to blasphemy. There are times when a family will suffer from foolish talk of the parents. And this was said of David in 2 Samuel 12:14. "Howbeit, because by this deed thou hast given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born unto thee shall surely die." And again, we are not going to understand the ways of God, but what did the child do to deserve that? Now, again, God is God, and God can do whatever he wants to do, and he can handle it however he wants to handle it, but the child did nothing. The child was innocent. It was David's fault. David will bear his sin, but the child had to deal with that too. And you and I have to understand that our family will suffer. The words that we use, the sarcasm that we use, the slang that we use, all of that will come back to us. I mean, I was driving down the road when one of my children was about 3 years old. We first moved back to Rochester. And there's the disadvantage to my kids going to my dad's side of the family for Christmas. And I was in shock. I was driving on Ridge Road. I can remember exactly where I was. And I had one child with me. And we were driving down the road, and I was just talking with her. She was talking with me. Again, about 3 or 4 years old. And, no, she had to be, let me think of how old she is. She was probably about 4 or 5 years old. She said, "Dad, we better hurry and get home, because Mom's going to be wondering where the hell we are." And we had just gotten back from Christmas with family, with my dad's side of the family. And they use words like that all the time. I mean, that's just to them, that's nothing. That's just conversation. And she picked up on it that easily. And we had a good conversation after that, as a matter of fact. And we discussed that together and helped them to understand that that is not appropriate. And although family members use that, we don't. But it's amazing how quickly people will pick up on that, and our family is affected by that stuff. You know what? Unsaved people know more about how we ought to live than we do sometimes. They know that Christians don't smoke, Christians don't drink, Christians don't use that kind of language, and yet Christians will fight to defend that and to justify why we do that kind of thing, why we talk the way we do. And we are hurting the name of Christ by doing that. The framework under this law, any case laws, we've discussed most of the case laws under the facts of the law, there's not a lot like there would be under some of these, like the dietary laws under commandment number 2, etc. And so there's very few case laws to be found in regards to this. You can talk about the using of vows in the Old Testament and some of that kind of thing, but there's not a lot in regards to the case laws under this one. So the fixture of the law, as we close tonight, how do we begin to gain control over our tongue and victory over the words that are sinful? Well, we're going to have to understand some things. Number one, you can't. We've talked about being careful of the content of our hearts, but the book of James says the tongue can no man tame. You and I are going to have to enlist the help of God if we're going to win over the language that we use, the words that we use, speaking too quickly. David prayed and said, Lord, set a guard, set a watch at my mouth. And that needs to be our prayer. We need to enlist the help of God. So we need to learn to pray in situations that where maybe our anger is stirred up. We're frustrated over something. And I know that there are certain situations when I'm working on a project or something, I've got to start off by saying, okay, Lord, you know, this is just you and I. And you've got to help me to just not let things bother me as I work on this. And I love doing projects around the house. I just enjoy that kind of thing. And but there are times when, if in the wrong circumstances, in the wrong mindset, that things will frustrate me a lot quicker than other times. I have to pray, Lord, you're going to have to help me to not say something I ought not to say, to not arouse any anger in me. And so I have to ask him for help. Our only hope, number two, is for us to keep our hearts and our minds pure. It's going to be our only hope. Learning to cast down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. 2 Corinthians 10:5. Proactively speak of righteousness. Make that a habit of yours to talk of righteous things, to talk of godly things. A daily prayer request, as I mentioned a moment ago, that God would bridle your tongue in every situation. David said, for there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Let the words of my mouth, the meditation of my heart, be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Number five, learn to discipline yourself and just keep your mouth shut. That's the challenge for us. And someone once said, as I mentioned in the notes, that it's better to keep our mouth closed and seem a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. A lesson to be learned by all. And the last thing is to realize and remember that God is listening to our conversations. Malachi 3:16 says, then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and thought upon his name. And those things are being listened to. God is paying attention to our conversations. This commandment is very important. And obviously God wants us to never take opportunity to use his name in an empty way. Whether that's in our conversations, whether that's in our lifestyle that would detract from his glory. But we have to be careful of the words that come out of our mouth, the language that we use. As we mentioned with Peter, he, in order to confirm and to make sure they understood what he was saying, he swore, he made sure, and listen, I don't know that man. I don't know him. And Peter understood what it would take to convince the outsiders that he was serious, and it all came down to his language, the words that he used, and it will confirm to other people what's true of us. The words that I use, the content of my conversation, the things that I like to talk about with people will prove what is in my heart, the content of my heart. And we need to always be aware. Never take the name of the Lord in vain. Okay, let's. Any questions or comments in regards to that? uh, All right, if you have time over the next 2 weeks to consider the question brought up tonight in regards to that, let me give you two questions to consider. I'm not telling you you have to do it, but I want you to consider this. From commandment number 2, maybe you can give some more input on this. The question came up in regards to the graven images and the pictures. Ought we to... there are people that when they have read that, took that to the ultimate extent and said they had to remove their pictures off their wall and anything in their house that represented some form of carving or engraving. Now, I'm not going to condemn someone for that. Hopefully you wouldn't either. But is that the extent of the law? Are we to take it to that extent or not? Then from this commandment, what does it mean that the Lord will not hold us guiltless? And maybe you can run a little study on that and give a better understanding of what that might mean to us today. All right, let's have a word of prayer together.